I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm talking today with Cheryl Kirschenbaum. She is a marine biologist working and doing research at Duke University and is an author and prominent science blogger, has teamed up now with a friend of this show, Chris Mooney, and they do a blog together at discovermagazine.com/intersection and have most recently authored a book together called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Welcome, Cheryl.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's our great pleasure. So I'm going to ask you some questions that you've gotten from many of your interviewers so far, I assume. But can you give us some sense of how scientifically illiterate Americans are? Are we especially scientifically illiterate, especially scientifically stupid compared to the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, all over the world, we hear different kinds of statistics on, people getting questions wrong that seem really basic, that are lessons that we all learned in elementary school, and we hear embarrassing statistics on what's larger, an atom or an electron, or how long does it take the Earth to go around the sun, so on like that. But really the book is about the much greater problem of getting the public to engage in scientific issues and policy and media and beyond. And I don't think we're unique in America that we're not as scientifically engaged as a society as we could be, but it's certainly something that we need to be thinking about here at home in terms of competitiveness in the economy and beyond.
Yeah, there are very few good examples around the world of populaces that are really engaged at a popular grassroots level with science and technology. I mean, do you have a model country in mind when you think of what it should look like?
Well, I wouldn't point to a specific region of the world right now that is getting everything right, but I think that there are certainly places where, at times, science seems to take a more prominent role or is less dictated by, say, religious ideology. Some places in the UK kind of balance both a little differently than we do, but yeah, we're definitely not alone.
So you're, as Chris has been in the past, and in this book, the two of you are very concerned about the ways that certain kinds of scientific beliefs on the part of the public or unscientific beliefs on the part of the public shape our science policy in ways that can be detrimental. The most egregious example, probably from a global consequences point of view, is climate change. We're ranking next to Turkey in terms of the percentage of the population that believes in evolution. And there are many other kinds of forms of scientific illiteracy that shape public policy. Is that how you're trying to connect this to, as you know, why we should care about scientific illiteracy? Is it that it has tangible consequences in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that for the most part, the only time we encounter science, or most of the culture encounter science, is through a lot of negative examples. I mean, we open the book talking about the Pluto controversy. And it wasn't so much that Pluto has to be reinstated as a planet, although it'd be great if it was, but we're more discussing how disconnected most people felt from the decision-making process. They didn't understand why it was no longer included, and it seemed like science was just taking their planet away. They couldn't participate at all, and we see that over and over with the Large Hadron Collider. People are afraid that the planet's going to get sucked into a big black hole, and you have these movies that come out where the scientist is always kind of the villain or the jerk, or totally socially inept, and it's very infrequent that scientists have a human face and science is portrayed in a real way that's relatable and relevant to all of our lives when it's a instrumental part of things we all encounter, of things we all experience on a daily basis. So I think that's really kind of one of the main central theses of the book.
So it's also that you're saying that our quality of life is diminished if we have this sense of alienation and disempowerment in relationship to this thing which keeps getting bigger and more complex in our world, in which fewer and fewer of us have a sense of empowered relationship to the scientific enterprise, technology, and and that you think it would improve all of our lives if we had more of that sense of connection.
Mm-hmm. I mean, instead of just kind of embracing science as central to our technology, like the phone I'm talking to you on now, or human health, climate change, as you said, and so many other issues, it becomes very threatening because it's become a very partisan issue. It's become fueled by a lot of ideologies. And it hasn't, I mean, people aren't thinking about science objectively anymore. So it's become kind of this special interest group in a lot of ways, and especially in political conversations, which are so important because they motivate and they inform the way that we enact new policies to mitigate the problems that we're encountering now and expecting to foresee in the not too distant future.
Well, let's address this issue, the partisan nature of science. I mean, Chris's book, The Republican War on Science, was about how the Republicans see this as a partisan issue and had then consequently forced the Democrats to mobilize around a neo-Enlightenment agenda. But I'm a sociologist, and when I look back, I see a 400-year politicization of science since the origins of science, which is that science has always been wrapped up with a critical approach to social and economic institutions and social practices. And so there has never been an epoch in which everybody just agreed science was a great idea and didn't challenge anything, didn't gore any of their bulls, the sacred bulls of their society. So isn't it true that this is not a new phenomenon, the politicization, the culture war aspect of science?
Well, science has certainly seen all sorts of culture wars, and it's waxed and waned in popularity. I mean, I think the epitome of the example is after the release of Sputnik, science was really celebrated in government, and right after World War II, it was seen as kind of our tools to stay very competitive in a global society. But at the same time, especially in the past 8 years, and continues to be seen as like a liberal agenda, or sort of this left versus right controversy. And it makes people kind of vote against science based on, which side they support of the aisle, when it doesn't need to be. And we certainly had a lot of examples of it's very easy to see, to blame the Republicans. And in many ways, the policy aspect of the book is a continuation of Chris's first book, The Republican War on Science. But I mean, there's examples throughout Congress. There's former Congressman Wayne Gilchrist, for example, who's a Republican who is very supportive of science. Vern Ehlers is another example of physicist in Congress. So it goes both ways, and then you have conservative Democrats who are sort of taking more anti-science approaches to a lot of policies, depending on what they think is going to win them votes. So it all comes down to winning votes. And when we heard on the last presidential election campaign trail, we heard Sarah Palin sort of making fun of fruit fly research, and Senator McCain's mocking grizzly bear studies, it was probably winning them votes, winning them points. And they knew by talking about certain issues as part of this left liberal agenda, they were winning over some folks. So that's really unfortunate. I think that has grown a lot compared to what it used to be just a decade ago.
Well, I don't want to pound this too hard, but this has been part of the reaction to this book, is that you are trying to make an appeal here in this book that scientists have some responsibility to get out there and communicate science to the public. And you have a very small portion of the book where you critique the new atheists as carrying on what you considered to be a counterproductive campaign, critiquing the religious beliefs of the public as a part of promotion of science. And you don't think that that's an efficient way to proceed strategically to encourage the public to be more scientific. But if one sees this as part of a centuries-long campaign of pursuing the Enlightenment, you know, then it is more of a culture war. So I just want you to restate that thesis, that this is not culture war. This can be a universal campaign for science, or universal support for science, the way it was back in 1960 around Sputnik. That's the vision that you see, a bipartisan support for science.
Yeah, we need bipartisan support if we're going to get anywhere. And this fuels a lot. I mean, a lot of my perspective on the science and religion relationship has been shaped by the people that I've worked with as I was doing science, but within other contexts. So when I was working on the Hill with a lot of policymakers, when I was working on the ground in communities to try to get some conservation initiatives going, a lot of the people I was working with didn't hold the same beliefs that I do. I'm agnostic, if anything. Chris is atheist. But they had this perception that all scientists kind of hated their God or just thought they were stupid or delusional. And that sort of gives them a reason for, you know, to turn off the science, to feel like they're alienated from it. And when it comes to being effective, when it comes to getting a policy through Congress, which is a lot of work, or when it comes to getting a community to work with you, you need to include as many different people in the conversation as possible. And so that's what the book is really calling for. And saying you don't need to attack, you don't need to confront, you need to try to work with people and talk and have a communication about why these issues matter so much.
Well, I'm completely on your side in terms of the need to have more science communicators and the army of scientists that you want to train to become a science corps to explain science to the public. But again, I'm kind of sympathetic with the notion that it's not scientists' fault as much as it is something different or intrinsic in the nature of the public. And it's not just the American public, because the publics of the developing world are probably as science benighted as the Americans are, but that, we need to focus on change at a kind of grassroots level in the public. And so what do you think about, I know you're probably a supporter of STEM education, science, technology, engineering, math education, but, you know, so why isn't that more of a focus than the putting the onus on the scientific community to try to communicate better?
Oh, well, I mean, we're certainly not letting anyone off the hook. I think that, in many ways, we want the book to celebrate these young scientists and scientists who are kind of making their way into a broader public arena and beyond. And it is important that the public is engaged as well. But I think, for the most part, we've been hearing, the public is stupid, people don't understand. And if we want our message to get across about what we do and why it matters and how it impacts people's lives, people's wallets, people's future and the future of their children and their children's children, then it's our responsibility to do a better job. And that's not to say every scientist has to go be this science ambassador the way Carl Sagan was. But I think what we really want to bring to light with this book is to talk about a lot of the statistics and in terms of the number of young people who are graduating with science degrees. We're seeing more PhD students than ever making their way through the scientific pipeline. So is extremely important to make science resonate more with young people and make it seem more paramount in their lives so they continue on and at least pay attention to scientific breakthroughs. And that has a lot to do with the news media cycle and so many other factors. But at the same time, we have a lot of talented people who understand science who aren't going to go on and land a tenured faculty position. And I think the statistic net or the odds of someone graduating right now with a PhD, according to the National Postdoc Association, who's going to go on and become tenured faculty, is only 7%. So there's a lot of young people who have these skills who aren't going to pursue this faculty position later on, but who could get a lot of the information out, a lot of the things that they've learned over the years to broader audiences in a way that's very effective. If they also have writing skills, if they also learn to be better public speakers, if they move beyond the classroom. And that would sort of solve the problem of what to do with all of this talent by employing them and getting them to be more engaged with their communities. And it can happen on the broad level or even the local level by talking to political leaders in their community or teaching in the classroom at their local elementary school. So there's so many new avenues that I think are being pursued. But, it would be great to see maybe some more federal funding geared toward interdisciplinary graduate work and so on.
I was pleased to see recently an employment survey that showed that the undergraduate majors that went on to make the most money in our society are now almost all engineers, a different kind.
I was looking at that too, I think.
Yeah, which I don't know how different that is from previous years, but my impression is that in the roaring 90s and even after, that there were so many people who had strong quant backgrounds and who might otherwise have ended up in something socially useful who went on to help destroy the world economy on Wall Street. So I'm really, you know, in a sense, the collapse of capitalism may be to the great benefit of science, that intelligent young people may decide to go on and do science. But besides making other things that they might do less sexy, what can we do to make science more sexy? I mean, you mentioned the Sputnik example, which was basically a national mobilization around the red threat, and that we have to get people, to mobilize on all different fronts to step up to the threat of communism. We don't have that kind of threat anymore. You know, our current global enemy are people living in caves in Western Pakistan. So it's not exactly that we need to have more scientists and engineers necessarily. But what is it that about the current period which will mobilize people in the same way? I think it might be, you know, the challenges around biotech and nanotech and some of these exciting technologies. But what do you see on the horizon?
Mm-hmm. Well, you started out by saying make it more sexy. So just to address that, I think in some ways that works, but you don't ever want to say you're going to dumb it down or, you know, make it flashy and popularized without, you know, limiting the substance. But I think you're absolutely right when you said mobilize. How do we mobilize people? How do I get the folks that I grew up with back home to understand what I'm working on and think it's as interesting as Us Weekly, which, you know, they're watching The Bachelorette and they're watching the reality shows and they have no idea what I'm doing here at the university. But we don't have Sputnik, but we do have an energy crisis. We are seeing food shortages that are probably spiking a lot of prices. I mean, we heard Obama on his campaign trail at one point said something like, have you guys seen the price of arugula at Whole Foods? I mean, we're seeing the environment changing. We're starting to feel some of the socioeconomic impacts of that, and it's only going to continue to change. So I think that fields like genomics and fields like also neuroscience are changing extremely fast, and we're going to need the communicators out there to explain what's going on in a way that's not terrifying and scary, but that's enlightening to the public who's going to be grasping on to a lot of these new technologies. And we have things like genetically modified foods coming into conversations. We have things like the water shortage that we're going to have to deal with, changing oceans. I mean, maybe themselves, they don't sound like, you know, the hot button issue. But if we hear about them more in the news, I mean, we rarely hear in the news science and technology stories. We only hear like a couple minutes for every 5 hours of regular mainstream cable news related to science and technology. So if we can start having more of a voice across different mediums, I think that people are going to be naturally interested in what these mean for their future. I mean, when any science story is told, it's why is it relevant to me, right? So we just need more of that out there and a lot of less noise background about, you know, whoever's dating who takes up 10 minutes of entertainment media.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have very much direct control over the media in the United States, except for PBS and places like that. If I could get personal for a second, I just want to mention the fact that my daughter, who had not evinced very much interest in science until the last year or two, she had a science teacher in high school who was a marine biologist and who had been doing grant-funded research as a high school teacher on genetics of coral. And she started coming home every day babbling about this, you know, scientific fact and that scientific fact. And we were just overwhelmingly, you know, overjoyed about it. And now she's going to be doing independent research with this teacher and going down to Honduras to study the genetics of coral. So
that is cool.
It's been totally cool on our side. I mean, I've always had a dilettante's interest in science, and I consider my show to be basically a science-based show. But I'm a sociologist, so, you know, even the science that I studied is pretty dilettantish. What was it for you that got you interested in marine biology?
Oh, my goodness. Well, how can you not be interested in marine biology? I really think you're just describing your daughter, but so many young people love science, but they're not calling it science. But, I mean, I have yet to see a six-year-old who doesn't think dinosaurs are cool and space is amazing and they want to go dig up things in their backyard. And then we sort of get distanced from that in the learning process in school when it's more about equations and statistics and that sort of thing. But I think it's also really, really easy to get turned back on to it. And that's what keeps museums as popular as they are. And that's why we see Sid the Science Kid being, you know, one of the best shows on PBS. So for me, it was also, you know, I got to college, I didn't think that I was going to major in biology or anything like that, and I had a professor who took me on some field trips and started explaining, you know, why this mattered, why, because I always thought I kind of wanted to do something conservation related, but he made the connection for me on a very, in a very personal way, as to how this mattered and why it was important to care about this. And we don't see enough of that in the mass media, but it would be terrific to have some more scientific luminaries as role models out there that people, I mean, most Americans can't name a living scientist. And when you ask them, with the people who can come up with something, which is, I think, less than half, the top three answers are Al Gore, Bill Gates, or Albert Einstein. And of those three, they're all either not alive or not a scientist. So a lot of the public image of even what scientists do is based on stereotypes, and their stereotypes perpetuated in the media, like I was saying before. So we need to really celebrate the people who are making a difference. And I think that that would influence a lot of people like your daughter, like a lot of my students here at Duke, to think about alternative careers in science, or just think about how they can contribute, and maybe how they can contribute in more non-traditional ways. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I hadn't done one of these congressional science fellowships in D.C., which I was really fortunate to have the opportunity to get involved with. But that's the first time that I saw science outside of my ivory tower sort of lens, and where communication really mattered, but I hadn't encountered that in the classroom.
You know, I've taught bioethics and the sociology of science for the last 20 years, and so that's really my avenue of engagement with science is through social, ethical, political ramifications of it. Do you think that this is one of the ways that we could encourage, A, scientists to become more sophisticated communicators to the public by encouraging them to, you know, branch out from their disciplinary shell to understand and be able to talk about more of these social consequences, and to get the public more engaged to see the connections between nanotechnology and things that may change employment policy in the rest of the century?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, all of these things are so important. And I think we also have to reduce the stigma of a scientist who wants to take a less traditional career. A lot of people that I work with here are very nervous to start looking at alternative opportunities right out of graduate school, because that's when you're supposed to be your most prolific in terms of publications. And you know, we have the publish first, publish or perish mentality, and you don't want to seem non-objective. You don't want to do something that'll make your colleagues think like you're going to be in trouble down the line. But it doesn't need to be that way. And I think that I don't think it's going to take a lot to change. I think we're already starting to see a paradigm shift in the way that many young people are approaching science. Chris and I get emails every week from people who are saying, you know, we want to do something, we want to learn to write, we're interested in policy. Can you put together a list of different opportunities for scientists that are emerging today to do something other than teach? So we're getting there, I hope.
Well, speaking of interdisciplinary, we do want to mention the fact that you're writing a book of your own now. Is this your first single-authored book, The Science of Kissing?
This is definitely my first solo project.
Okay.
It's been really interesting, and I've learned so much from Chris, just because you know, my background training is as a scientist to sort of publish in terms of stating the facts without a bunch of metaphors and analogies, and working with Chris, whose background is so strong in science journalism, has shaped and enabled me, I think, to write for broader audiences. And
well, I love these interdisciplinary efforts. Your book on the science of kissing reminds me of a book I have on the history of the chair, and there's another book on the history of dust. And it's a wonderful way to bring together, you know, history and sociology and science to look at one particular thing. But it sounds like a really exciting thing. You're bringing together neuroscience and evolutionary biology. You're just about at the completion of this project, The Science of Kissing.
Yeah, I'm about a month turning it in, and it is a lot of fun looking at a single behavior through so many different lenses and sort of trying to pull some themes together but make it about something that is almost universal, so people should probably feel somewhat related to the topic, I hope, and come away with a little more knowledge about science than maybe they had before they got started.
So do you buy the contemporary interpretation that it's a way for women to gauge the health of, or for men and women to gauge the health of the partner before they decide to commit to procreation?
Well, I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, there's the potential for hormonal exchange. There's the potential for assessing how healthy the other person is, or you know, whether you have different kinds of immunities, but there's so many other factors in terms of what's going on in the brain and the way that, you know, you're positioning your body next to the other person. And then there's so many things happening within our bodies that we're not even consciously aware of in terms of neurotransmitters. So it's a very broad look.
And is it universal? Are there societies that don't kiss?
There are societies that don't kiss, but over 90% of cultures do kiss. And the ones that don't usually do other, some, you know, they tap noses. Some people pay attention to each other's eyelashes. I mean, there's a lot of different behaviors. Sniffing is a very, very important behavior that we've seen historically throughout sort of human cultures. And it's waxed and waned in popularity as people have changed. But I go into a lot of the anthropology and the evolution looking at primates, and how primates have sort of changed as we've stood upright, and how visual cues became more and more important, and we started focusing on each other's lips. So it's a really, really intimate story about one of humanity's long-term exchanges that I think helps perpetuate the species in some ways.
Wonderful. Well, that sounds like a wonderful book, and we'll have you on to talk about that as well. As I said, we've had Helen Fisher on to talk about the science of love, so the science of kissing will be next.
Well, fantastic.
Absolutely. I've been talking with Cheryl Kirschenbaum. She can be found at cherylkirschenbaum.com and also at discovermagazine.com/intersection, where she and Chris Mooney blog, and also at their book now on Scientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future, on the bookshelf today. Thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.